Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library. Yeah.
Kia ora. Well, at Karen's suggestion, today we are talking short stories. Karen, tell us why short stories. It's the calendar, Louisa. It's the calendar and it's the Writers' Festival. So Writers' Festival is coming up next month. People are booking their tickets. And I've noticed some really top short story writers among the guests at this year's Writers' Festival. So, for instance, Jenny Zhang, who is Brooklyn-based, as might be guessed by the fact that her website is jennybagel.com. Also the fact that her book of short stories that she'll be reading from at the festival is called Sour Heart, which I find a very Brooklyn-esque, and the fact that she comes recommended by Lena Dunham. And we've also got Karen Joy Fowler, who's in her 60s now. I was surprised. I remembered her as being in her 40s, but time does go by. A long career, including she was the writer of the Jane Austen Book Club that a lot of people know about, but she also writes wonderful short stories with a sort of a science fiction fantasy bent. Has won lots of awards, such as the Nebula Award, which gives you an idea, but they're not the shoot you out with ray gun type books. They're quite thoughtful and often with a point of view from a particularly women's point of view. One of her famous stories that won a lot of prizes was called Black Glass, which I think gives you an idea there. And then Paula Morris and Anton Blank, two from New Zealand, both New Zealand Maori, who Paula's remembered by many writers for her, by many readers for her Forbidden Cities, which is a wonderful collection of short stories, which traveled the world exploring things like escape. I'm quoting from the Writers' Festival booklet here, transgression, ambition, delusions, and desire. And Anton, his short story collection is called Global Roaming, and he presented that. He launched it at this year's Same, Same, But Different LGBTQI Festival, and then came and talked to us about it on Books and Beyond. So what I'm thinking is, I know a lot of people think that they don't like short stories. And as librarians, we need to battle all prejudices, but especially prejudices about forms of writing. So I thought today we could feature some the joys of short stories. And I thought I'd hand it over to you to begin.
Oh, great. Well,
also,
here we go.
I also thought.
Well, first of all, Karen.
Walls in your court.
Thank you. But I want to thank you, actually, for bringing short story to the fore, because I actually love short stories. It's I've been from those you find in magazines to the, you know, the collections and the books, you know, that you've been mentioning today. I read somewhere that short stories originated from oral storytelling, which explains the appeal to me, I think, being part Polynesian. And my father and the rest of the family are great oral storytellers. So perhaps that's why in the written form the short story appeals to me. But I'm going to leave it to Australian author David Miller to explain the magic of short stories. He has an anthology of the 100 finest short stories ever written, and I think it's a treasure. So
would that be the tome that you have sitting on the table in front
I've
of
done
you?
It again, haven't I? You know, chose the biggest book in the library to bring into the studio today. But anyway, so Mr. Miller says of the short story, "I can curate to show that a short story can do pretty much anything. Tell the story, tell the untold story, hide the teller, make you laugh, make you cry, show a world, be political, play and work and expand what fiction can do," and so on and so forth, as can any novel. But as a short story, it's already a distillation. It gives the writer a far harder task to achieve everything, not just anything. It's clever, isn't it?
Very clever.
Yeah.
Very so on point, as they say.
I love this book, I have to say. It's something you want to keep close by and read whenever you want to indulge in a quick read, knowing you don't have time to do it. The magic of the short story. So
So what's your first offering?
Well, it seems the stories are sorted by chronological birth date of the authors. So first up is the first... Oh, here I go again, trying to find the right page. But anyway, in amongst page 292 is an offering from our own Catherine Mansfield, A Married Man's Story. So I won't read the whole story, though for a short story we probably could on the radio show. But I want to read this piece. To me, it just shows that you don't lose that descriptive passage just because it's a short story. So here we go. Outside it is raining. I like to think of that cold, drenched window behind the blind and beyond, the dark bushes in the garden, their broad leaves bright with rain, and beyond the fence the gleaming road with the two horse little gutters singing against each other and the wavering reflections of the lamps like fishes' tails. While I am here, I am there, lifting my face to the dim sky, it seems to me. It must be raining all over the world. That whole earth is drenched in something with a soft, quick patter or hard, steady drumming or gurgling or something that is like sobbing and laughing mingled together. And that light, playful splashing that is of water falling into the still lakes of flowing rivers. Isn't that lovely?
It's so beautiful and so New Zealand.
It is,
the long
isn't
white
it?
Cloud.
Yeah. You just think of sitting at home in Auckland. And, yeah. You know, it's a lovely piece, and I really enjoyed that story and so many others in this book. But also, have I got time to give for you a little bit from one of my favourite authors, Julian Barnes?
One of my favourite authors as well, and has a new book out now, which I've requested but have not yet had in my hands.
Oh, right. I haven't, we'll have to catch up later and talk about that.
Yes.
But anyway, Mr. Barnes, being born in 1946, features on page 71. And the story is called Marriage Lines. So it's a couple holidaying on a remote Scottish island. I'll read a little bit. It's quite enjoyable. The first time they had come to the island, they weren't yet married. She had worn a wedding ring as a concession to what? Their imagined version of island morality. It made them feel both superior and hypocritical at the same time. Their room at Callum and Flora's B&B had whitewashed walls, rain drying on the window, and a view across the Macar to the sharp rise of the Ben Martin. I hope I got that Scottish pronunciation right. On their first night, they had discovered a bed whose joints wailed against any activity grosser than the minimum required for the sober conception of children. They found themselves comically restricted. Island sex, they had called it, giggling quietly in each other's bodies. Isn't that lovely?
Oh, that's so Julian Barnes.
Yeah. But quickly...
Very droll.
Quickly.
Understatedly.
I want to point out that learning new knowledge or picking up new knowledge is not lost in the short story either. So so the host of the B&B, Flora, she takes out of a drawer an old sweater which had belonged to her grandfather. She laid it on the kitchen table, ironing it with her palms. In the old days, she explained, the woman of these islands used to tell stories with their knitting. The pattern of this jersey showed that her grandfather had come from Eriskay, while its details, its decorations, told of fishing and faith, of the sea and the sand, and this series of zigzags across the shoulder. These here, look, represented the ups and downs of marriage. They were, quite literally, marriage lines. So there we go. There's more about what the patterns on the jumper mean. And so that really appealed to me, also being of Scottish heritage. So that's my offerings on short stories for today.
Those are lovely.
100 of them?
Yeah, I noticed that Julian Barnes was quite near the end, so I'm not sure how far up into contemporary short stories that goes. Who's the very last one in the book?
Oh, yes. That's a good point. Let's see. Have we got time to flick through to the last offering? Oh, gosh. The Deep by Anthony Doerr, born in 1973.
Is that Anthony Doerr of All the Light We Cannot See? Isn't that Anthony Doerr? How's it spelled?
D-O-E-R-R.
Yeah. That's the one, Anthony Doerr. So I think it's interesting what your book highlights there in the excerpts that you read is that short stories come in many shapes and sizes. And a lot of people have one of their prejudices against short stories is derived from the fact that they were forced to read them during high school in very short versions because it was thought by the teachers that children's attention spans otherwise were not long enough. But there are a lot of short stories which are actually like a whole chapter, they're long, they're like a whole chapter of a book, and you can really get into them and follow the characters, and then there's others that are just a moment in time that are thrown at you for effect, and that's the one that I've brought today that I want to read. But I did want to mention a few of my favorite short story writers I haven't brought excerpts from, but I'd like to put forth Elizabeth McCracken, who was a librarian, is an ex-librarian, who writes beautiful short stories, and also George Saunders, who won the Booker Prize with Lincoln and the Bardo, but was made his fame as a short story writer in 10th of December as one of the best short story collections that I've ever read. So I put forth two of my favorites.
Thank you. I just want to add, too.
Yes, please.
I don't recall ever, after reading a short story, not having that moment to reflect and you know, and think a little bit more, whereas quite often in the longer version, you sort of get to the end and go, okay, well, that was an interesting read, or why did I pick that up, you know? So, you know, I mean, just that different feeling that you finished with.
Yeah, and which is obviously different for all different kinds of people as well. So the short story I brought is called Bullet in the Brain by Tobias Wolff, and this is a short story, and I'm going to read the whole thing. So this short story came to my attention particularly. I had taken home a book of Tobias Wolff short stories, and I hadn't even begun it yet, and I got a phone call at the library from a gentleman in Remuera who was looking for Bullet in the Brain by Tobias Wolff, which had been recently declared by someone famous, I can't remember, the most perfect short story ever written.
Wow.
And so I said, oh, actually, I've got it at home on my bedside table. And this very gentlemanly gentleman said, oh, no, I wouldn't have you bring it back just for me. No, I must. I said, I'm a librarian, our readers above all. So I did. I brought it back. Sent it out to Remuera Library
for
him.
For the cause.
Anyway, then I did get the book, and I read it, and I agree it is actually a perfect short story. So I'm going to share
it. It should be in my book, but
Yeah.
So we shall listen. Thank you so much.
So listen with perhaps not bated breath. It's not quite that short, but listen with
expectant breath.
Bullet in the Brain, Tobias Wolff. Anders couldn't get to the bank until just before it closed. So, of course, the line was endless, and he got stuck behind two women whose loud, stupid conversation put him in a murderous temper. He was never in the best of tempers anyway, Anders, a book critic known for the weary, elegant savagery with which he dispatched almost everything he reviewed. With the line still doubled around the rope, one of the tellers stuck a position closed sign in her window and walked to the back of the bank, where she leaned against a desk and began to pass the time with a man shuffling papers. The women in front of Anders broke off their conversation and watched the teller with hatred. Oh, that's nice, one of them said. She turned to Anders and added, confident of his accord, one of those little human touches that keep us coming back for more. Anders had conceived his own towering hatred of the teller, but he immediately turned it on the presumptuous crybaby in front of him. Damned unfair, he said. Tragic, really. If they're not chopping off the wrong leg or bombing your ancestral village, they're closing their positions. She stood her ground. I didn't say it was tragic, she said. I just think it's a pretty lousy way to treat your customers. Unforgivable, Anders said. Heaven will take note. She sucked in her cheeks but stared past him and said nothing. Anders saw that the other woman, her friend, was looking in the same direction. And then the tellers stopped what they were doing, and the customers slowly turned, and silence came over the bank. Two men wearing black ski masks and blue business suits were standing to the side of the door. One of them had a pistol pressed against the guard's neck. The guard's eyes were closed and his lips were moving. The other man had a sawed-off shotgun. Keep your big mouth shut, the man with the pistol said, though no one had spoken a word. One of you tellers hits the alarm, you're all dead meat, got it? The tellers nodded. Oh, bravo, Anders said. Dead meat. He turned to the woman in front of him. Great script, eh? The stern, brass-knuckled poetry of the dangerous classes. She looked at him with drowning eyes. The man with the shotgun pushed the guard to his knees. He handed up the shotgun to his partner and yanked the guard's wrists up behind his back and locked them together with a pair of handcuffs. He toppled him onto the floor with a kick between the shoulder blades. Then he took his shotgun back and went over to the security gate at the end of the counter. He was short and heavy and moved with peculiar slowness, even torpor. "Buzz him in," his partner said. The man with the shotgun opened the gate and sauntered along the line of tellers, handing each of them a hefty bag. When he came to the empty position, he looked over at the man with the pistol, who said, "Whose slot is that?" Anders watched the teller. She put her hand to her throat and turned to the man she'd been talking to. He nodded. "Mine," she said. "Then get your ugly ass in gear and fill that bag." "There you go," Anders said to the woman in front of him. "Justice is done." "Hey, bright boy, did I tell you talk?" "No," Anders said. "Then shut your trap." "Did you hear that?" Anders said. "Bright boy, right out of the killers." "Please be quiet," the woman said. "Hey, you deaf or what?" The man with the pistol walked over to Anders. He poked the weapon into Anders' gut. "You think I'm playing games?" "No," Anders said, but the barrel tickled like a stiff finger and he had to fight back the titters. He did this by making himself stare into the man's eyes, which were clearly visible behind the holes in the mask, pale blue and rawly red-rimmed. The man's left eyelid kept twitching. He breathed out a piercing, ammoniac smell that shocked Anders more than anything that had happened, and he was beginning to develop a sense of unease when the man prodded him again with the pistol. "You like me, bright boy?" he said. "You want to suck my dick?" "No," Anders said. "Then stop looking at me." Anders fixed his gaze on the man's shiny wingtop shoes. "Not down there, up there." He stuck the pistol under Anders' chin and pushed it upward until Anders was looking at the ceiling. Anders had never paid much attention to that part of the bank, a pompous old building with marble floors and counters and pillars and gilt scrollwork over the tellers' cages. The domed ceiling had been decorated with mythological figures whose fleshy, toga-draped ugliness Anders had taken in at a glance many years earlier and afterward declined to notice. Now he had no choice but to scrutinize the painter's work. It was even worse than he remembered, and all of it executed with the utmost gravity. The artist had a few tricks up his sleeve and used them again and again. A certain rosy blush on the underside of the clouds, a coy backward glance on the faces of the cupids and fauns. The ceiling was crowded with various dramas, but the one that caught Anders's eye was Zeus and Europa, portrayed in this rendition as a bull ogling a cow from behind a haystack. To make the cow sexy, the painter had canted her hips suggestively and given her long, droopy eyelashes through which she gazed back at the bull with sultry welcome. The bull wore a smirk and his eyebrows were arched. If there'd been a bubble coming out of his mouth, it would have said, "Hubba hubba." "What's so funny, bright boy?" "Nothing." "You think I'm comical? You think I'm some kind of clown?" "No." "You think you can fuck with me?" "No." "Fuck with me again, your history, capiche?" Anders burst out laughing. He covered his mouth with both hands and said, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry," and then snorted helplessly through his fingers and said, "Capiche, oh God, capiche." And at that, the man with the pistol raised the pistol and shot Anders right in the head. The bullet smashed Anders' skull and plowed through his brain and exited behind his right ear, scattering shards of bone into the cerebral cortex, the corpus callosum, back toward the basal ganglia, and down into the thalamus. But before all this occurred, the first appearance of the bullet in the cerebrum set off a crackling chain of ion transports and neurotransmissions. Because of their peculiar origin, these traced a peculiar patter, flukishly calling to life a summer afternoon some 40 years past and long since lost to memory. After striking the cranium, the bullet was moving at 900 feet per second, a pathetically sluggish, glacial pace compared to the synaptic lightning that flashed around it. Once in the brain, that is, the bullet came under the mediation of brain time, which gave Anders plenty of leisure to contemplate the scene that, in a phrase he would have abhorred, passed before his eyes. It is worth noting what Anders did not remember, given what he did remember. He did not remember his first lover, Sherry, or what he had most madly loved about her, before it came to irritate him, her unembarrassed carnality, and especially the cordial way she had with his unit, which she called Mr. Mole, as in, uh-oh, looks like Mr. Mole wants to play, and let's hide Mr. Mole. Anders did not remember his wife, whom he had also loved before she exhausted him with her predictability, or his daughter, now a sullen professor of economics at Dartmouth. He did not remember standing just outside his daughter's door as she lectured her bear about his naughtiness and described the truly appalling punishments Paws would receive unless he changed his ways. He did not remember a single line of the hundreds of poems he had committed to memory in his youth so that he could give himself the shivers at will, not silent upon a peak in Darien, or, my God, I heard this day, or, all my pretty ones, did you say all, oh, hell kite, all? None of these did he remember, not one. Anders did not remember his dying mother saying of his father, I should have stabbed him in his sleep. He did not remember Professor Joseph's telling his class how Athenian prisoners in Sicily had been released if they could recite Aeschylus, and then reciting Aeschylus himself right there in the Greek. Anders did not remember how his eyes had burned at those sounds. He did not remember the surprise of seeing a college classmate's name on the jacket of a novel not long after they graduated, or the respect he had felt after reading the book. He did not remember the pleasure of giving respect. Nor did Anders remember seeing a woman leap to her death from a building opposite his own just days after his daughter was born. He did not remember deliberately crashing his father's car into a tree, of having his ribs kicked in by three policemen at an anti-war rally, or waking himself up with laughter. He did not remember when he began to regard the heap of books on his desk with boredom and dread, or when he grew angry at writers for writing them. He did not remember when everything began to remind him of something else. This is what he remembered. Heat, a baseball field, yellow grass, the whir of insects, himself leaning against a tree as the boys of the neighborhood gather for a pickup game. He looks on as the others argue the relative genius of Mantle and Mays. They have been worrying this subject all summer, and it has become tedious to Anders, an oppression like the heat. Then the last two boys arrive, Coyle and a cousin of his from Mississippi. Anders has never met Coyle's cousin before, and will never see him again. He says hi with the rest, but takes no further notice of him until they've chosen sides, and someone asks the cousin what position he wants to play. Shortstop, the boy says. Short's the best position they is. Anders turns and looks at him. He wants to hear Coyle's cousin repeat what he's just said, but he knows better than to ask. The others will think he's being a jerk and ragging the kid for his grammar. But that isn't it, not at all. It's that Anders is strangely roused, elated by those final two words, their pure unexpectedness and their music. He takes the field in a trance, repeating them to himself. The bullet is already in the brain. It won't be outrun forever or charmed to a halt. In the end, it will do its work and leave the troubled skull behind, dragging its comet's tail of memory and hope and talent and love into the marble hall of commerce. That can't be helped. But for now, Anders can still make time. Time for the shadows to lengthen on the grass. Time for the tethered dog to bark at the flying ball. Time for the boy in right field to smack his sweat-blackened mitt and softly chant, they is, they is, they is. You
British it you are. And then you go home with you on your own. What do you really do? Mr. Lady, why don't you tell it like it is?
Stereophonic song, Mr. Writer. Thanks for listening in today. Ka kite.
Ka kite. This program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz
and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m.
on 104.6 FM
or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/booksandbeyond. Every day.